Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is me, Jonathan Alexander. I'm here to host our show, Life, Laughter, Happiness. And today I have my co-host, Barbara. Are you there, Barbara?
Yes, I am here. Hi, everybody.
All right. Now, our guest today is returning guest, Albert Lanier. Apparently, since we last spoke, I guess, a lot of things have happened. Am I right?
Hi, Albert.
Yes. Hi, how are you, Barbara? It's good to talk to you, and
great.
It's good to talk to you, Jonathan.
Well, we were so happy to hear from you and that you wanted to come back and talk to us, and that was before the whole alert, which I think Johnny is talking about. A lot of things have happened. But before we begin, maybe we should let the listeners know who you are in case they didn't hear the first show. So would that be okay to give you a proper introduction?
Yes, please. Yes,
great.
Barbara. You can.
Yes, Barbara. Okay, so today we have Albert Lanier, and he has been a journalist and writer for more than 21 years, maybe longer now. And he holds a BA from the University of Hawaii, West Oahu, and has been a contributing writer for Pacific Business News and Honolulu Weekly. He is also freelance for a variety of publications, including Hawaii Magazine, Asian Week, and Edible Hawaiian Island. That sounds yummy. So I just wanted everybody to know a little bit of background before we begin.
Right.
I mean, you've been a writer. This is what you've done pretty much your whole adult life. And
right.
You went freelance. And then you were retired. And I said, but you sure are busy for being retired. So now this is part two of something new you've been working on. Am I correct?
You could say that. Well, since I retired in 2017 when I was technically 46 years old at the time. I hadn't turned 47 yet. Since then, I've written a blog for medium.com, and it's coming up on its third anniversary this month. I just recently wrote a blog piece, my first of the year. I should have been writing more, but my first of the year, about the coronavirus. It was entitled Germs, Steel, Virus, and How the Coronavirus is Upending Historical Trends. So that just came out yesterday, my blog on medium.com.
Wow.
And
yes, I haven't seen that yet, but tell everybody
again
where they can find it. On Facebook, is that where we can find your blog?
Right. Well, if you go to my Facebook, which is under my name, Albert Lanier, L-A-N-I-E-R, you know, there's a meme up there. I just posted it on my Facebook yesterday. It's also on Twitter, my Twitter page, my Twitter wall, at Critic Incorporated, which is my Twitter handle. So, you can go to Facebook and Twitter. You can also go to medium.com if you want to read it there. I think it's at the Dr. 50. I think so. That
okay.
Technically,
so awesome.
That'd be medium.com/@the Dr. 50. Sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We will post all of that too on all of our social
right.
media after this interview and get that link to you. And we will, you know, send it out to all of the handles for us, Life, Laughter, Happiness, and you. So that's good. I just want everybody to know where they can find you. And so. This is a lot. This is just like almost, I keep saying, the virus. It's going to affect us closely. Like, it already has me. I have a very good close friend who's already lost two people in New York City, vibrant young people who were very good at what they did, you know, career people. I mean, it's starting to get close. It's getting too close,
right.
And it's scary, very scary.
Right.
So tell us your thoughts on that and a little bit about what you wrote in your latest blog entry.
Right. Well, just as a little bit of slight setup, I, of course, have been impacted like a lot of people. I don't want to go into my personal too much, but I've been impacted much like most people that I'm sheltered in my apartment, and I haven't left where I live in a couple of weeks. And so this particular malady, this particular contagion, I gave a couple of interviews previously and hadn't done any since then. And so this is the first in a couple of weeks. And part of that, I think, is observing what's gone on in the larger, not just the larger media, which is what people have been glued to, television and the internet and maybe radio to some extent. But also looking at, you know, hitchhiking from what I had said early on, I was interviewed by a podcast called Parallax Views. And what I noted about this crisis is that it's a health crisis tethered to an economic crisis. And in my view, in my analysis, the economic crisis, as bad as the health crisis is, and in terms of the U.S. especially, it's terrible. This health, this economic crisis is going to be worse. But getting to my blog piece, which I just wrote, my historical analysis, because I want to make a disclaimer, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a medical expert, so I can't talk about symptomology and clinical aspects of the virus. So I'm just a journalist and writer, so I'm not even a science journalist, so I can't go into those details because
that's okay. I want to know more of what you were talking about, your thoughts and your feelings and how, you know, it's just affecting your mind and being closed up, and 2 weeks is a long time to just stay in your apartment alone. And I mean, you must have really stocked up with food. So,
well, yeah, I'm actually kind of here with relatives, so I'm not entirely
alone.
So.
Okay, good.
Yeah. For me, it's been, I've just briefly stated that before going on my blog piece. For me, it's been a little unusual in that I'm not a homebody. I always like to go out. I've been doing that for as long as I've been around, I guess. I've never been somebody who likes to stay home and just, you know, settle down in a room or whatever.
Sense. I mean,
this is unusual for me, but it's...
You grew up in Hawaii, didn't you?
Yeah, so I'm used to kind of going out, especially now that I'm retired, going out to events and going out to different places. So I kind of adjust to being indoors all the time, which is bizarre for me and strange, but managed to get through it. I mean, so far, so good. But getting to my blog piece, my historical analysis, which is the analysis that I'll provide because I'm not a medical expert, is that what I've noticed about this virus that I don't think most people will say on the major media and the so-called mainstream media, which I call the dominant media. My assessment is I see this as an upending of the normal historical trends in world history. I see this as the normal historical trend in world history. What I've noticed about this virus is that what is getting hit is the first world, what is known as the first world, to use the language of the Bandung Conference of the 1950s. You're seeing countries like Italy and Spain become hot spots for this disease, this contagion, coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, and I think to some extent SARS-CoV-2. You're also seeing nations like the UK impacted. The United States has become kind of the epicenter of the crisis. You also see nations like Iran that was hard hit, and of course China, where the virus ostensibly originated from. and came from. So that's what you've seen. And my assessment of this and what I noticed was that all of these, that most of these hotspots and most of these nations where there are significant high cases especially, were former imperial powers. Italy was the seat of the Roman Empire, Spain, of course, the Spanish Empire. The UK, where the cases are going up, it's not the biggest hotspot, but cases have gone up. Of course, it's the seat of the largest empire, probably one of the largest empires, the British Empire. Even Iran was the former Persia, the Persian Empire. And, of course, China was the imperial power. These are all former empires. And so, especially in regards to Europe, what's happened is that the former seats of empires have – it's sort of a reversal of history. It's a reversal of what I would argue have been the historical trends. And the reason I state this is because when nations – Italy wasn't a nation until the 19th century. But when these former seats of empire, what was the Roman Empire, what was the Spanish Empire, even the U.S. has had a small empire. And certainly the UK, Britain. They started going into yes.
Albert, one question. What about Canada? I don't know about their history. They're not a part of an empire, right?
What is
they're
that?
They're getting hit really hard. Canada?
The virus has spread across the globe. So there are a massive amount of countries that are getting the virus. But what I noticed were some of these nations that became hotspots, that became what I would call pandemic points, because of large numbers of people killed every day and in total. And not only in terms of the people who died, but also the amount of infections. What I noticed is that they were former empires.
Right.
There are places
okay.
that had global dominion. That's what I assessed and what I found, and I thought, well, this is interesting. And the reason I state this is because these former imperial powers had gone into what is now known as the Third World. Again, to use the language of the Bandung Conference, going into the Third World, places like South America, places like Sub-Saharan Africa, and even parts of Asia. And what's happened is what they brought with them in terms of over the centuries that they acquired parts of Africa and South America and even Asia, what they brought with them wasn't just the technology of the period and guns, for that example, thus guns and steel. They also brought with them diseases. And these had tremendous impact on indigenous populations, impacting and wiping out some parts of areas in these regions. And so what I noticed is that the Third World, per se, like I said, not just Sub-Saharan Africa, but also parts of South America and even
and
Asia,
Mexico,
have
right.
been able to have actually not borne the brunt. See, in the past, when you notice these other viruses like SARS and MERS and H1N1 and even Ebola, they've hit and targeted the Third World or some of the former colonial possessions in Asia. Now you're seeing a disease like coronavirus, COVID-19, strike the First World, Italy and Spain and
like,
the UK and the U.S. First World, technologically advanced, wealthy nations. And so I see this as an upending of historical trends. I see this as a sort of and so that's what's been very apparent to me in looking at this virus. That's what's intrigued me about it, is that, I mean, that's the reason partly why this is a global pandemic. And these other viruses that I mentioned weren't considered global pandemics. Well, they didn't spread to over 100 nations in the way that this coronavirus has, but that's what intrigued me.
I see exactly what you're saying. That is so very interesting because, like, even Prince Charles, I mean, that's the furthest you can get away get
right.
away from a third world country right there. So mm-hmm. what do you think
right.
is why? I mean, is there a reason that you are like thinking this is happening?
I think that's a good question. And let me see. It's interesting because I, you know, because this is a disorder and a disease that even experts at places like CDC are still trying to reckon with, because I think it was discovered in 2019. And there's still a lot that's not known about it. It's hard to figure out why specifically this has really wreaked havoc, in my view. I'm sure the medical experts and I'm sure a lot of the doctors that have looked at this will have their reasons and their opinions, their professional assessment as to why. I, as someone who isn't a doctor, can't give you a clinical or symptomological or symptomology-laced view of this. But what I see from a historical point of view is an ending of sort of the world historical pattern. The third world has borne the brunt of many deadly and destructive diseases, and now the first world is bearing the brunt. It's almost as if it's a sort of, this may sound odd, because viruses aren't sentient. I mean, viruses are destructive, microscopic entities, but, they're not sentient, intelligent beings. But it's almost on the order of it's almost anti-colonial, anti-imperial the way this virus has worked. I mean, it's intriguing to me. It's something I haven't seen before. I mean, the only other global pandemic I can use an example of is the Spanish flu, which happened in 1918, back to the 1920s.
I read about that too, yes.
And it's killed far, and that killed, according to historians and doctors now in this century, killed about 50 to 100 million people, I think the estimates are now. We don't know how many people are going to die as a result of this coronavirus, but we do know that this virus has sort of changed historical trends from my analysis of this. What's also intriguing to me, I don't know how valid this is as an assessment, is what I noticed about some of these other countries that were hard hit by this virus is that they were near bodies of water. If you look at Italy, if you look at Spain, if you look at China, if you look at Iran, if you look at the U.S. and U.K., some of these countries where there are major infection rates, you don't see a lot of nations that are sort of getting very, 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 very high COVID-19 and coronavirus infection rates and death toll that are in Italy, from what I've seen thus far. Now, that could change because you never know what a second wave of the disease could bring with it. But what I noticed in my assessment thus far was that these are near bodies of water. They're either bordering it or surrounded by it. How much that is a factor, I cannot say. Again, I'm not a medical expert. I'm just sort of giving my layman's point of view and my layman's assessment and analysis. And those are
right,
the two things that I've noticed in regards to this.
It's very interesting that you are coming up with this, because it is so true now that you pointed it out. That is so very, very true. This is making me feel like maybe I need to wear my mask when I go down to look at the ocean. I mean, it's just crazy how we just don't know. It seems very highly contagious, and that makes sense, touching an elevator button and somebody else does, and then, but it's just such a very powerful, very harsh, mean virus. It's and then it'll be so interesting to see, because they're going to find out a lot about it eventually. They're going to why are some people recovering? Why are some people just, they get it and the next day they die? I mean, it's just very, it's going to be very interesting to hear, the scientists find and discover what this is really all about. Isn't it?
Right. Well, it's a bit scary in the sense that they don't know a lot about it, so they're kind of at this point catching up, trying to figure out, people trying to come up with a vaccine, and so they're kind of scrambling to find a way to defeat this, and how it can be defeated, I don't know. In regards to that historical analysis that I do in regards to empire and the sort of imperial, what I've noted is what's also been, you also see the role, and this might be uncomfortable for a lot of people to face, but it's a reality, the role of how race plays into what I call medical imperialism, and which is what not only the kind of military imperialism that has come with European nations and other nations grabbing parts of the globe for their own dominion in terms of military and economic aspects, but also what I call medical imperialism. Recently, two French doctors, I think, were on a TV show saying they wanted to test a potential vaccine for COVID-19 coronavirus on sub-Saharan African individuals, and in fact stated that they used the example of prostitute, because a prostitute would be open to all kinds of potential infections or potential outbreaks, I guess because of what would be termed, put in polite terms, commoditized sexuality. And so that's what I would call medical imperialism, an indication of medical imperialism, how the first world views the third world and how it is viewed certain populations within the globe. They are supposed to get diseases because they don't have the medical systems, they don't have the technology, they don't have the economic infrastructure to be able to fight this off. Well, what's happened is the first world, even with its medical systems, its economic infrastructure, and its technology, hasn't been able to do it. You saw it in Italy, you saw it in Spain, you've seen it in the United States especially, where you have nurses coming into hospitals wearing plastic bags because they don't have the gowns and equipment. They're looking for ventilators.
That's another thing that I was thinking. Why aren't we more prepared for this? It always goes in waves. If you look back into history, these pandemics happen. So, like, we have earthquake kits. Why don't we have, every family should have a virus kit where there's masks in there and there is essential things that you need. Go ahead.
Sorry, this is my question. I didn't know if anybody was hearing me. Would you say this disease is about as deadly as HIV, or would you say it's less or more?
Would I say that it is, that the virus is deadlier than what precisely?
It's HIV.
That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, but has it killed more people than that? Do you know the statistics on that?
The whole HIV, the whole AIDS epidemic, not quite pandemic, is very, I mean, I think this is historically fraught in terms of the coronavirus and politically fraught. But that's really politically fraught because you had a disease that was impacting vulnerable populations and what were at the time viewed as marginal populations. Don't want to get quite into that because that's a whole – in one sense, I would say that certainly in regards to Ronald Reagan when he was in office, I frankly don't think he gave a damn about people impacted by AIDS. And I think the political order at the time didn't for a number of years, especially when AIDS was called GRIDS years ago. prior to it becoming auto, what is it?
Autoimmune
deficiency disorder. It was GRIDS. In a sense, the only thing I see linking them, and I don't want to link the two together, is I think AIDS was born from political bigotry and just the contempt for certain populations on the part of right-wing political forces two or three decades ago. I think that had a lot to do with it. It was silence. It was it's only a certain part of the population and a certain aspect of it that are getting it and not others. With this, it's also a political aspect, economic aspect, but I think it's born of the First World. Like I said, it's born of these former imperial powers and some countries that went out of their way, at least some of their leaders went out of their way to downplay and dismiss and write off this coronavirus as a flu, as unimportant, and even so-called medical personnel. To be frank, I mean, there are people, not only in the media, but who pop up in the media. Fox News is a great example of that. You get people like Trish Regan, who got fired for seeing this coronavirus as some kind of attack on Donald Trump, political attack by Democrats on Donald Trump. You have Sean Hannity, who outright called this a hoax.
Oh, wow.
And then went back and tried to state, well, we always took it seriously, and I never called it a hoax. Outright lie. I mean, if there's somebody who should be fired, it's Sean Hannity. And I would also add to that Dr. Drew Pinsky and Dr. Oz, who both downplayed this virus. Dr. Drew went on Fox and other channels and said, well, you know, it's like the flu. Don't worry, go out to restaurants. And Dr. Oz himself, they both blamed the media, the major media, as inciting panic, inciting harm to this. I consider both these men snake oil salesmen with medical degrees. I have nothing but contempt for them. Nothing for contempt, but contempt. I've never cared for Dr. Drew anyway. But I don't want to get into those. They know what they've done.
I can't hear what Johnny just was saying. It was unclear. Could you repeat that, Johnny?
The doctor that works with Trump, I'm trying to think of his name. He's been the head of the coronavirus task force.
I think you're talking about Dr. Fauci?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he is trying to tell the people, I feel, the truth about it. What do you think, Albert?
Well, he's a medical professional, and I think he's done the best job he can under very difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
Especially in an administration that has basically poo-pooed the problem and tried to sweep it under the carpet and now cannot. I could talk forever about that, but I'm not going to. I have other things to discuss, and I want to focus on that. Yeah.
There's a lot to discuss. You might have to just come back for that discussion on those other topics. But so this is very interesting. So when you saw the similarities, and all of the countries that are being attacked the most were in empires. So then what are you taking from that? How do you feel about that and those similarities? Like, I want to get to the climactic stuff here.
Well, what it says to me is it's almost, like I said, it's a reversal of what I call global historical trends since maybe the 14th, 15th centuries, since European powers and other kinds of powers started creating major empires upon the earth. And that's what I saw. I saw a reversal of fortune historically. And I think that's why this has become not just the major deal that it is, because it is a global pandemic, but it's because the seed of empires were hit. Italy was hit. Spain was hit. U.S. is hit. U.S. has a small empire, but is an imperial power nonetheless, which people often forget. So it's intriguing to me. I mean, that was what I saw, and I think it doesn't surprise me that people aren't seeing it, because I think a lot of people are kind of focused on all the straightforward material and economic and even political ramifications of this virus. So it doesn't really surprise me. I think people are practical minded in many respects, especially a lot of so-called everyday people, working class and poor people who are frankly getting the brunt of this disease in this country and in other countries. The people that are really suffering are those who have no resources or very little to no resources. And those are the people that are catching the front of this disease, the face of this disease head on. And it's tragic. It's really tragic.
It certainly is. And the people in Mexico, I've been watching a lot about different pandemics, epidemics. Mm-hmm. And what about Mexico when they hardly even had a vaccine for the actual normal flu? And so, I mean, these countries are so behind. I don't want to see it hit them. That's really going to be sad. We think it's bad. We were not prepared. We don't have enough ventilators. What about them? Right. Yeah, that is, it is tragic.
Interesting you bring up Mexico. I understand. Don't you do some charity work for people in Mexico, I believe, or you're involved in that?
I did do that a lot.
Right.
Doctors for
right.
Charity, and I fly there. Yes, and I work closely with them. Yes, and my friend Kurt, he lives down there. I just recently went down there. And yes, they're not even prepared for the actual real flu, let alone this. Yeah.
Right.
Barbara,
well,
we have a
unfortunately, from what I've seen in Mexico, the president of the country didn't really take the coronavirus seriously. He was kind of, to be blunt, dismissing it, almost not quite in the same way as Trump, but close to it. You know, he saw it as unimportant to be prepared and unimportant to deal with it. He was saying he didn't want it to get in the way of normal Mexican customs of greeting people, kissing and hugging and so forth. And that's changed because the amount of coronavirus cases have gone up. They've gone up in Mexico. So they've had to get serious about the outbreak and the disease. In fact, I believe it was the government of El Salvador or someone in some officials in El Salvador that begged Mexico to start taking it seriously sometime back. They were saying, you've got to stop dismissing it, stop minimizing it, and start taking it seriously.
Yes, because other countries can send them ventilators and things they need because they've gotten through this, and they can send them. So they need to just be honest. And do you think that they're not honest at first because they don't want to cause a panic?
Oh, yeah. There's dishonesty that's going on, and not only in this administration, but in there's a good deal of it.
I think Johnny's
trying
to get in a little bit of a point here. Yes, Johnny, I keep hearing
right.
him trying to get in there.
We have a caller. We have a caller.
Oh, we do? Oh,
yes. I'm
going to
go
okay.
ahead and
well,
put the caller.
Albert, are you okay with a caller?
Sure. Yeah, why not?
407.
Okay.
407. Hi. Hi, you are on live with Albert Lanier. What is your name?
Hi, Barbara. This is Lori from Florida. How's everyone doing tonight?
Oh, Good. Hi, Lori. Meet Albert Lanier.
Hi.
Lori is
Hi, how are you?
Well. That's probably why she wanted to call in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. No, definitely. I just appreciate your take on everything that's going on. I was listening before online, and I do believe that there are, you know, multiple layers of things that are transpiring, of course, affected by the virus, but I think this is a great opportunity for people as yourself, Albert, if
mm-hmm.
I may call you Albert, to
yes,
pretty much educate us on how or what your take is on this for us to conduct business in a more local way. I think it's going to bring us back to basics and also with writing and publishing. However you want to explain it, I would love to hear your take.
Okay. It's interesting because one of the things that I've noticed about the response, and I'm going to get to sort of the second part of this, which is the economic aspect, my economic analysis. As I mentioned
mm-hmm.
before, I believe this is a health crisis tethered to an economic crisis. And what we've seen is a massive economic crisis. I would call it already, when I was interviewed on a podcast called Parallax Views last month, I said it's already become a recession. And I think that's the case. It might turn into the Great Depression 2.0, frankly, because you're seeing at the time it was 2.5, and then it became maybe 6. Now I'm hearing 10 million unemployed people. You're possibly over 20% unemployment rates. And the impact has not only been borne on primarily on workers and employees who have lost their jobs and are forced to stay at home, but also on small businesses. And a lot of small businesses are going to be wiped out. Now, getting to your point about writing and publishing, that is part of what I call the cleavage of sort of stay at home versus working outside the home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's indicative of the kind of distinctions that have been caused or maybe exacerbated by this crisis. And it's going to be interesting because I was a freelancer for 22 years and worked largely from home to see what the impact is going to be and is on freelance writers. A lot of that, of course, has to do with this nature of the media, print media in particular. Print media has been going through a lot of financial issues because of lack of advertising that was impacted by the growth of such factors as Craigslist, which took a lot of advertising away, a lot of classified ads over the years. Google itself also. You're still, you know, print advertising, print publications, even online publications. As you know, in terms of that, I'm sure there are publications that are still hiring people and in terms of at least freelancing. And there are maybe still publications that are looking for freelancers. How much of that, I don't know. Like I said, I've been retired from freelancing for 3 years. So I write a blog. So although I'm still a professional writer, I think my last paid gig was, what, last year, and I got the check earlier this year in January, so that money got spent before this crisis happened. In terms of dealing with that as a writer, I think it depends on the state of print media at this point and of online media at this point. We'll see what happens in that regards. The best I think you can do – are you a freelancer?
Yeah, yes, indeed.
Okay.
I am.
Okay. How have opportunities been for you to freelance there in Florida?
You know, I've been so caught up in my personal life that it's almost like taking a back seat, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I write, and now I pretty much do it for leisure as opposed to approaching people, marketing myself and
mm-hmm.
going that route because, you know, I think to myself, People are not in the frame of mind to want to talk about things like that. Mainly I deal with small businesses, and I'm very cognizant of the nature of what's going on. I'm living it. I'm in the mix. So I have taken a step back from promotion and gotten more into the artistic side. A lot of unpublished things that I've been working on and been able to catch up on.
Interesting.
But yeah, for some people, logical. I don't think it is
that
hurting.
Seems,
like, for me, it's
that
not.
That seems logical
yes,
to me.
It is
but
hurting.
In terms of the financial aspect, it depends on the print media and how viable they still are, not only in your area, but online, too. That's what I would say. And I can understand why the marketing and promotional aspect, which is what a lot of freelancers have to do more and more of these days. I've said this before. You now have to be a promoter and marketer because of Facebook and Twitter and other aspects of the internet than I did when I started in the 90s. The 90s, 94 when I started in the 90s, all I had to do was just find work. I had to promote and market myself to the public, let alone to anyone else. But now you have to.
Well, it's going to hurt a lot of people, but for me, I can probably do even better. I mean, with my online sales and the things I do at home online anyway, but it's so sad. I cannot go out. I was on such a roll with my shooting and doing photo shoots and being back here in California. I've just loved every second of it, and 2020 was going to be so amazing, and shoots lined up that I've had to cancel in Toronto, but it just I mean, I did get an N95 mask in February when nobody else, I mean, people laughed at me. Why would you do that? Well,
they're not laughing now.
You know? Yeah. They're not laughing anymore.
They're not laughing now.
No.
But this also presents itself as an opportunity. An opportunity in, you know, getting back to what did our parents do and their parents and their parents before that, you know, what was it about them that,
they started having babies. There's going to be a baby boom because they got to do something fun at home. You know, they're isolated. So, I mean,
all of us are so stuck in our phones that we don't even do much of that anymore. I mean, people are pretty much in their own headspace. It's not the same. I mean, things are very, very different. It's almost like taking us into a Back to the Future movie.
Well, I could use a plutonium powered DeLorean just about now and go back in time.
I was looking at the moon the other night, saying, "Gosh, I wish I had a rocket ship. Can I live there?" You know, I mean, things that you just aren't even thinking about.
You have to ask Jeff Bezos about that one.
I know. I probably could make it happen.
Or Elon Musk. Both guys I don't like. So
to know what you think, Albert, but the bigger picture here, what is going to happen with the economy? Mm-hmm. You were going to get to that, weren't you?
Right. And and some of what I set up, what I intend to do now is sort of take a sort of slightly go back and then go forward. So my thesis has been, when I was interviewed earlier, my thesis was that this is exposing what I call the rot and decay of the American economy. And I think this economy, though it was promoted as a fantastic one and a great one, was in essence not a great one for most people. It was a high profit, but low-wage economy. In other words, CEOs and heads of corporations and companies did extremely well. Of course, a lot of these companies like Amazon and Apple and Google weren't paying taxes, but that's the result of the Trump tax cut. But it's also the amount of wages that have gone down. So the average worker and employees, they weren't doing very well. And my point about this is to state that what's happened is we've gone, in my view, these are my terms, we've gone from a productive economy in the 20th century and before that largely in the 20th century, it was a largely manufacturing base, at least the economy that produced products in the United States, where you had factory jobs with livable wages, especially after World War II. You could be a high school graduate and work at a factory and have a livable wage and send your kids to college, buy a home, buy a car, send your kids to college. And we've gone from a productive economy that I think was largely manufacturing-based to a reductive economy, which is largely retail service economy-based, food and beverage, stores, et cetera. And we're seeing that, and that's what's happened. And so wages were lower, cost of living was up, but wages were lower, and benefits were little to non-existent in a number of these jobs. So what we saw was a decrease not only in regards to the kind of jobs that workers and employees could get, but also the value of the jobs and the value of their wages. And so what's happened as a result is we've got this economy that has not worked for workers and employees. And I would argue this wasn't just prior to this coronavirus collapse of the economy. It's been going on for 30, 40 or more years, at least since the 70s. And I cite the 70s because in the 70s, what you had was a couple of factors at least, two or three factors. One was the Lewis Powell memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that outlined a sort of blueprint for the corporate class and the business classes to essentially take over elements of this of the sectors of this economy. Of this country, media and political systems especially. That's why money has been a gigantic part of politics, the increase in PACs, for example, political action committees, and also the role of what's not only the change in the economy, which has happened, which is it's gone from a manufacturing sort of based economy to a financial based economy, where banks and insurance companies are more important. They play a larger role, and they have much more control of the overall economy. What you're seeing, and so I think the Lewis Powell memo provided the blueprint for the business class through the Business Roundtable, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but other entities, also through think tanks like American Enterprise Institute and others to exert an intellectual presence and a financial presence on the political system and the educational system and on the media in general, the major media in general. I would also turn to two other factors. The first is Richard Nixon's decision in 1971 to take the United States off of the Bretton Woods system.
Off the gold standard.
Precisely. Absolutely correct. And to decouple the dollar from gold because a lot of countries were able to get gold because of the reliance on the U.S. dollar, able to get gold from the U.S. And Nixon's move was to sort of prevent the U.S. from losing all its gold ostensibly. Then the next move came in 1974 when you had, I guess it was Henry Kissinger who was the Secretary of State. I don't know if he had lost his National Security Advisor statement as well, but when Henry Kissinger I guess this is still during the Nixon administration. I don't know if he had retired yet. But also when Henry Kissinger made the petrodollar deal with Saudi Arabia, where you saw in 1971 the decoupling of the U.S. dollar from the gold standard and from gold, what happened was that the U.S. dollar was tied to oil. And so what nations across the globe and across the world had to do was get dollars in order to get gold. They had to stock up on dollars, a situation that exists from this day. I think one phrase that was used was as good. The dollar became as good as gold. I would argue that that has helped keep the U.S. economy from completely collapsing, that petrodollar move. I think that's the reason the U.S. still has an economy. But as we said, we see it during this crisis. We've seen the sort of removal of manufacturing as a major part of this country. There's still manufacturing in this country, but it's nowhere near what it was before. And so we have that coupling of the dollar to oil via the petrodollar deal. And so I think that's extremely important. I think that has been, because if you look at this crisis, I think one of the pieces of currency that's done well thus far in terms of globally is the U.S. dollar, at least from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's done well. Some other currencies have not done well globally. And that's because people need the U.S. dollar, especially to get oil and other resources. And so I look at those three factors, you know, the takeover of American institutions and America in general, to me, by the corporate class, by the business community, because of the Lewis Powell memo, the blueprint provided by the Lewis Powell memo in 1971. Also in 1971, Nixon's taking removal of the U.S. from the post-war Bretton Woods system and from the gold standard, and the 1974 petrodollar. And what's been created over the years, we've seen a decrease in wages, and we've seen a move towards the financialization of the economy, especially in the U.S. And that's why what we've seen with this current act that came out, the CARES Act, the $2 trillion act, what I noted on another interview was that the president was sort of taking the New Deal structure, a New Deal framework approach. That's true, but the framework is one for the rich, not for the rest of the country, unlike FDR's New Deal.
Right.
So businesses are getting bailed out to the tune of billions of dollars. The airline industry is getting billions of dollars, including Boeing. You have a what has been called a slush fund, $500 billion, at the direction of the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who I call Slumlord Steve. That's just my view, what I call him, which is unprecedented in many respects to have a Secretary of the Treasury have this much control over a huge chunk of money that can be given out to businesses. So I think a New Deal framework, I call this a New Deal for the rich, that this bill has engendered. Yes, there's $1,200 for supposedly every American or most Americans, but I think this was kind of used as a lure to get a sort of collective, to get people behind this act. And this economy has not worked for workers. And so when you look at these, when you look at the historical factors, what it has produced is an American economy that no longer provides jobs and living wages and good wages for workers, that doesn't allow them to easily pay their bills and even be able to get through college without loans, which are putting people in debt. It's an economy that doesn't work for most people. And let me just note some of the aspects of this coronavirus that have impacted, that we can see that's impacted people from that perspective. The Washington Post had an article on April 6th that noted the impact, the toll of coronavirus on essential workers. For example, the fact that grocery store workers are getting infected at significant rates, and some of them are dying. People who work at Trader Joe's, people at Walmart, the impact, again, what this virus has done is it's essentially, in a sense, devoured the poor and devoured the working class. And the New York Post had noted that 33 MTA workers, bus and subway workers, had died of the coronavirus thus far. We're looking
at... I know they're not protecting them. And, oh, they say, okay, wow, there's tons of jobs out there. Yeah, but now these jobs are going to kill you. You have to risk your life going to your job every day. And I even feel like I'm risking my life just going to stop in for 10 minutes to the grocery store, let alone work there day after day. I don't even know how they have the mindset to do that. Do you?
I wonder how these essential workers are doing it. They're deemed essential workers, grocery store workers, gas station attendants, and other types of workers. But they're not
being
paid,
Albert,
essential pay.
Cable guys came out here. They said that this is an essential thing. I said, are you sure it was down my cable? I said, are you sure the coronavirus? I mean, they're still coming out. And she said, it's an essential job, yes. And we cannot get it on your TV working through the phone, so he has to come out. I put my gloves and my mask. I stayed away from him. I cleaned his area, you know, and I mean, I just couldn't believe that they were still sending out TV people.
Right, right. So we also know that there's been a death toll on doctors and nurses, over 100 thus far killed because of this virus across the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I noted when I looked at the larger economy and the impact on how the economy hasn't worked for workers, and it's not working now. Annie Lowry, a writer for The Atlantic, in August of 2019, noted that despite the high, as I mentioned, high wage, high profit, low wage economy, supposedly a great economy, that it is, quote, the worst job market in over 80 years because the millennial generation is making less money than even the so-called baby boomers. Despite supposedly a higher economy and a wealthier economic framework in this country. And this is, you're seeing this in regards to these low wages in terms of student debt and the cost of living, which is rocketed. Let's think in aspects like rent and mortgages and food. Another interesting point, she also wrote an article in February in The Atlantic. And what she noted, this is before the crisis broke out, and what she noted, and this kind of dovetails with what I've been seeing, is that families have been bled dry in the supposedly great economy. Quote, families have been bled dry by landlords, hospital administrators, university bursars, and childcare centers. Quote, 4 million, a roaring economy felt precarious or downright terrible. And we can sort of see this in other data. Gallup poll has been looking at the impact of disasters and major events on the American population. And so when it came to this coronavirus, it's interesting. Contrasting people who made like $36,000 or less, or maybe $90,000 or more, when they looked at three factors, stress, worry, and sadness, 62% of those who make $36,000 were stressful or had high degrees of stress. Interestingly enough, 64% of those making $90,000 or more also had stress. Worry was about 64% for those making $36,000, 60% for those $90,000 and above. Interesting, sadness was a little different, 45% for those making $36,000 and less, and about 28% for those $90,000 or more. So it's interesting to see some of these statistics. And, of course, politically, very big differences between the two parties and others. 67% in terms of stress for Democrats, 48% for Republicans, 70% of worry for Democrats, 44% for Republicans, and then 39% sadness for Democrats and about 23% for Republicans. Of course, there have been a wide amount of discrepancies and a sort of real divide between the two parties anyway over the years. But it's capturing sort of a statistical indice of how people are reacting to this and a little of how they feel about this coronavirus pandemic and epidemic. And
I love your breakdown. I love the way that you are so diligently breaking it down socioeconomically, spiritually, just about ethically and everything else. What a well-rounded answer.
Oh, well, I guess it's I'm used to it as a journalist. You always want to get some data. You want to get some cited sources. It's something mm-hmm. that old habit, you know, I don't like talking about something just off the top of my head without marshaling mm-hmm. facts, without figures, without some kind of grounding in
betting
data and reality. And so that's
That's so important. I mean, you're writing about it. You've got to know details and statistics and percentages and all of that. And it is so interesting. But I just have a question about Trump, do you think that this is going to be, I mean, his downfall, like finally we'll have a downfall because of the way he's handling this? Because I remember when there was the Katrina flood and the way that Bush handled that, oh my gosh, nobody likes him after that. So how do you feel about, I know a little bit about how you feel, but what do you think about that? I do.
I'm not really surprised by how Trump has handled this crisis. I think what he's done is, like I said, indicative, going back to my historical analysis, I think it's indicative of first world attitudes toward these crises. You know, pandemics aren't supposed to come to America. They're not supposed to come to the UK. They're not supposed to come to Spain or Italy or Germany or France. You know, France and Germany have also had significant cases, though not as bad as Italy and Spain. But it's not supposed to come to first world wealthier nations, but it has. And
the last thing he was expecting to happen.
I think for him, it's sort of surreal. You know, there was a reality, not a reality show guy, but I remember there was a reality show called The Surreal Life. I forget what it was about. But that's what it seems like with this administration. You could just call it, every press briefing and every aspect, you call it The Surreal Life or The Surreal Show. Just call it The Surreal Show. Their responses have been inadequate. And I'm being generous in saying that. I think that they are camera ready, but not crisis ready. And it's evident. It's evident how it's impacted parts of New York. You know, and which has been hard hit, and parts of the country.
He should have just really faced it, and as honest as he could, faced it. I mean, it's not an individual fault. It wasn't his fault that this virus is coming to us. I mean, it's not really his fault. So I don't know why they would have to shove it under the rug and act like it isn't as bad. If he... And then he can't, here, Vice President, you handle it, you know. No, that's not what we wanted to hear. We wanted to hear our president, he is going to handle this and be honest and just don't act like it's going to go away. Let's just expect it to get really bad so then we're prepared, not just act like it's going to go away and hope it goes away and hope nobody notices. I mean, this is... I just don't think it's been handled very well in that respect. And also, when you see them, the children are watching TV too. Okay, wear your mask, wash your hands, don't touch people. But then you watch the news and all of the top leaders, well, our top leaders are still shaking hands and they say, well, you know, that's just not me wearing a mask. That's just not me. Did you guys see that when Trump said, oh, that's just not me? It's just not fashionable enough. But I mean, what? I mean, yeah, it is ugly. It doesn't look so good, but it may save your life. I mean, people now are just making masks. By the way, my mother, it was my idea. I said, Mom, please, you have so much fabric. Let's make masks together. Now I can't obviously go fly to see her, but she started making tons of masks. Then she even went to a city over to buy elastic that she ran out of. And you can only buy one package of elastic per family now. Did you know that?
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that this is all very interesting, but I think that me, as the co-host here, I would like to say, everybody, try to figure out a way that you personally can help. You personally can. If everybody helps in some way, that would be a lot of help, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's an interesting – I think that's a kind of valid point. And I think some people – I think they're doing that in their ways. You know, some people are doing that, whether it means, you know, making masks or
write about
people
it
who
like
have,
you, and maybe Lori's going to write about it. You know, writing about it, that's so helpful. Give us something to read, that maybe a different take on it, like you're giving us now, that's helping a lot.
Right.
Opening up people's minds. Yeah.
You know,
that's about all I can do at this point is write something positive.
Right.
Right. I don't know if what I wrote will be of any benefit as regards to this crisis. I'm not under the illusion that, you know, what I wrote is going to somehow help solve the coronavirus crisis.
Well, not
it's an analysis.
People's minds up.
But yeah, the analysis would be good, because at least we have a starting point of understanding, and, you
mm-hmm.
know, people can write their congressmen. People can write their senators. I mean, Albert, it is a starting point.
Yeah.
Anytime you educate people with hard things to hear, you know, because I totally turn off by any kind of news media. I don't like for someone to tell me how to think. I'm perfectly capable of doing that on my own. I get my news bits from research. I do my own research, and I compile my own formulations and hypotheses of what, and you did a fantastic service for all of us by your delineation of the history that brought us to today. That was amazing.
Right.
That's pretty much what I do. I do the history searches and my own hypothesis.
Well,
we're
about
you know.
Oh,
right.
Well, wow. We're talking about. Okay. Well, that is true. But thank you so much, Lori, for coming on and acknowledging our wonderful guest and what he's doing, Albert. And I just want to make sure
all
we
I did
do
was
shout
write
out your blog so we can all read. What was that?
It's on medium.com. So I think you can reach it on medium.com. medium.com/@the Dr. 50. I believe that's the way to get.
By the way,
hopefully that'll be.
50,
that,
did you say you turned 50?
Yeah.
medium.com/@the Dr. 50.
Yeah.
But did you turn 50? I think you were trying to tell me that before we went on air. Did you have a birthday?
Yeah, I did. I did during this. I did just this past week.
And you know what, Johnny and I couldn't keep up with the birthday shout outs of all of our guests. It was like, it was getting confusing, right, Johnny? It was hard to like keep track of it all. But happy belated birthday. And that was a big one. When was your birthday?
It was April 3rd.
Do you know what? April 3rd is a special day. I'll never forget your birthday again because, right, Johnny? That was my 1 year anniversary of my first appearance on the Life Laughter Happiness show. 1 year anniversary. April. Yeah. Wow.
And me and Lori share a birthday.
Wow, that's amazing. So, well, happy, you know, 50. That's a big one. How do you feel about
yeah.
it?
it was kind of an odd one. You know, it was kind of odd. I guess I never thought that I would be stuck indoors and spending the day basically arranging an interview or interviews, which is what I did,
know.
Basically.
I was thinking about that the other day. Look, if you have your birthday and you couldn't go anywhere, I mean, you just have to deal with it. And it's not the end of, you know, the world that you can't go out on your birthday. But, I mean, it just is so like, okay, wow, look at where we are. Look at what we're going through globally. But, you know, we can, like Lori says, just try to do something positive. And what you're doing, I think, is opening up people's eyes and, you know, writing about something in a different slant than they were actually thinking, opening them up, opening their eyes up. And also, we've had another guest on our show, a psychic medium, and she said this is all, yes, it's horrible, but it's also all about love, because a lot of people are coming all together as a globe. It's globally. I feel it. When I do go out, I feel good energy. I don't know about any of you, what kind of energy you're feeling when you go out, but I'm feeling like when I do greet the grocery store clerk or the postal service person, say hi and thank you for what you're doing, they generally are pretty upbeat and happy. I mean, I had to have a person come out for 4 flat tires, and that guy was grumpy. But other than that, it's pretty good energy around. What do you think about the global energy of just people's attitude coming together to try to, you know, control this?
Well, some parts of the globe, in regards to how they've handled this crisis, had demonstrated that they've been able to handle it from a medical point of view. South Korea, for one, they treated it like a microphone, in a sense, testing, 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 and they were prepared. Taiwan is another one. They prepared in December of last year, 2019, December of 2019. They activated their National Health Command Center, coordinated within their agencies, and they used data from their insurance program, national insurance program, to link up with individuals. And so if you look at countries like Taiwan and South Korea, they're showing that there's a way to at least fight this virus and to have some success, relative success against it. I don't know. It's hard to have real success against a virus of this nature, especially one that you don't know all the characteristics of or just finding out about in many respects. But I think that's a cause for optimism.
Yeah.
What Taiwan's done and what South Korea's done. And to some extent, although it's been controversial what China's done, but they had the infrastructure. They had fought SARS and other viruses before, and so they had the fever clinics, they had quarantine hotels, and they had they built like 2 hospitals each in less than 2 weeks to fight this virus.
That was amazing. I saw that too.
Yeah.
That was absolutely amazing. The
right.
way they built that so quickly.
Right. So that indicates that there are ways to respond and ways to have an impact against the virus. And if that's a sort of global energy or a sense of possible optimism in regards to the CV virus, the coronavirus, COVID-19, then you know that's worth looking at and examining.
Yes, we've been examining a lot, haven't we, Johnny? We have been with different guests on. So this is a whole nother take on it. We appreciate all this information. I wasn't so sure, though, that this is exactly what you wanted to talk about today, Albert. But it went in that direction. So we can also have you back another time if you would like to talk again. About,
sure.
You know, maybe some more upbeat things when this hopefully dies down.
Or maybe by then.
Yeah.
It
would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, we will certainly see what will happen in regards to this pandemic. And, hopefully somehow it will get under some measure of control and there'll be some semblance of public life again.
And where do you live exactly? I know that you are in the LA area, correct?
No, I'm in Honolulu.
You went back to Honolulu?
No, I've lived in Honolulu for the last decade or more. I was in LA, back in 2008. Yeah, 2008. Yeah, I lived there.
Okay.
I'm kind of jealous because of the lockdown in California, places like the 405, and although I don't drive much, I did get on bus in other areas. I mean, you look at those freeways out in LA, and they're like virtual, they're empty.
It is amazing. I have just from Huntington Beach driven up one time since this has happened, and it was okay, it's usually an hour and a half. It took about 35, 40 minutes. It was really nice. And it seemed like, okay, this is how it should be in a perfect world.
Right.
The traffic.
Right.
It was really amazing. Yes. Okay. So now, yeah, I remember now. So you're back living in Honolulu. What is it like there, though? I mean, are they, do they have the stay-in rule? Are they making you wear masks and giving you fines if you don't? Because now we
I think some people have been ticketed here in Honolulu. I've seen that on Facebook. Some people are getting ticketed by the cops for, you know, being out.
Right.
it's indicative of what's going on across the planet, I guess, not only in this country. But, yeah, I mean, Hawaii has a 14-day quarantine. So if you're flying in as a tourist, I don't know why you would be flying here as a tourist. But if you're flying in as a tourist or somebody, you got to go through a 14-day quarantine.
Wow, nice vacation.
And, I know. So far we've had, I think it's over 200 cases here. It's been a few deaths. So we haven't had
that bad.
It's been minimal. We've been fortunate, I would say, compared to some other states like New York, especially Michigan, and others where, in Ohio especially, where there are major hotspots in the country. Louisiana is another one. So I guess we've been fortunate. You know, it's been sort of odd. You know, I look outside my window and there's a park right outside and people outside playing football and I see cars in the road and it doesn't seem different. It seems the same in many respects, which is interesting, you know.
I know, and it is surreal, though. It is strange when you go out because it's not like you just are going out to you're protecting yourself and you're going out. I feel like I'm risking my life, but you're looking around, like, how are other people feeling emotionally? And it's just kind of like a numb feeling. I mean, people are all polite, though. It's like that's what I'm talking about, the good energy. Is that you don't see other things like the regular road rage or the lines. I mean, probably because those have been taken out. There's no long lines. There is no traffic. I mean, it's just kind of the way it should be, you know, I feel. It's just weird.
Right.
People, they're not talkative. And then they come out with saying, well, you can get it from talking to people.
Right, I've heard that.
I just can't wait till we just know everything about it. And
right.
You think
that's
we
a very
will
good
know
point.
Everything about
yeah.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It's a very good point. When that is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't
well,
know.
It will be very interesting. So
yes.
Just stay safe, and we will definitely be reading regularly. How often do you update your blog? How often do you write on your blog?
Well, that was the first article this year, so I've been remiss in writing blog pieces. And this month's my anniversary of my blog, so I've got to write an anniversary piece. It's normally tradition, so I have to decide what I'm going to write for my anniversary piece.
Do you ever have interviews on your blog? Do you ever interview people on your blog?
I haven't, but I've thought about it.
Yeah, that would be
why you
interesting. Oh, I want to be interviewed. That's why.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. Oh,
yeah,
I would consider, yeah, I'd consider doing that.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
That would be
just
great.
Let me know.
Okay,
yeah.
I want to. All
okay.
right. Well, you guys, thank you. Also, Lori. Lori, can you tell the audience your full name and where we could connect with you on Facebook as well? Since, you know, Lori's a good friend and she does. We met her through the show because she calls in
Lori,
a lot.
Lori disconnected.
Oh, she did? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that was nice that she called in. She probably was so excited to hear you and talk to you and ask a couple of questions because she's a writer too. She wanted to write something
mm-hmm.
on Johnny and I soon for the show.
No,
so that
great.
Was, yeah. But
yeah.
Thank you so much, Albert, for coming
thank
back
you.
On. And I would like to have my interview by you.
Okay. We got to do that. It's always nice to be interviewed by a beautiful woman. So on the show.
Well, thank
always. You.
And please try to keep your spirits up and your creative juices flowing for all of us to enjoy. And stay safe.
Okay.
Stay in, and all of your family. You know, we wish them to stay safe too. And
all right, thank you.
And that is it. And please, everybody, listen to all of our other shows on our YouTube channel, Life, Laughter, Happiness, along with the latest here by Albert Lanier. And check out his blog on Facebook. And we would love to hear from you on our website, too, and Twitter and Instagram. So thank you again, Albert, and hang in there.
Thank you. All right.
And happy belated 50th birthday.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Good night.
Have a great night.
You too.